Tom Kramer, substituting for Julia Bernard, and we had such an overwhelmingly positive response from last week's guest, that we decided, luckily, to bring him back, and luckily, by a good aspect of force, I'm pleased to reintroduce Greg McMichael. And, Greg, I noticed we'll start right where we left off, I guess, last time.
Okay, that sounds great.
We had a great show.
I was kind of surprised at how many people had listened and have made comments and called the station. So thanks for having me back, because there's a lot we didn't cover last week.
It's good to have you back. And, you know, I think the more that I think about what we talked about, the more I wish that more people were actually openly discussing and speaking their minds, because I think a lot of people feel the same way. It's just that they don't say it. And I think somehow saying or talking about these things is a form of exorcism. It exorcises out the bad things that are happening. And at least
that's why analysts make the money they do.
I think you're right. And I think you really got an important point across, especially your conclusion last week when you told people not to be afraid. I think that's really critical. I really think fear is like a mental cancer. Now, let's switch. There's some things that we didn't get into last week that I thought we should. Number one, I did not get into the, if you don't mind me discussing it, your amazing art collection. I've been over since the last show to see it. Now, one of your pieces is a cocktail. How did you come across that?
Cocteau
drawing?
It's a colored pencil drawing of a rooster, and it's signed and dated 1956 by Jean Cocteau. And I've acquired a lot of my collection from the O'Gallery auction house. Mm-hmm. There's just a couple blocks here from KABU. Mm-hmm. And from time to time, they get some pretty amazing works through there. I've seen Albert Bierstadt recently, and they've got a lot. They run a lot of Dolly and Erte, and there's just a whole bunch of different things. You never know what you're going to get. I've got a really nice Louis Bunce there, and a Tom Waddingham, and a Sister Mary Carita, an original watercolor of Carita's,
the original '60s poster artist.
Yeah. Yeah, and so yeah, I've had really good fortune at that auction house.
We also saw a Hank Pander that you had that was a really nice one, a piece he did.
It's called The Gorge. The companion piece to that hangs at the Maryhill Museum. And while the whole SNL thing was falling down and all the savings and loans were being routed out for their corruption, the Far West Federal Savings had an auction as well, and they were auctioning off everything in their offices, including their art. And so I was able to get that big Hank Pander there. I also have some things by his sons, too, and the whole family's really gifted.
Yeah, definitely. It's sort of like the Dutch tradition. A lot of Dutch artists, even now, trace their ancestry back generations after generation. It kind of is it's almost like in the bloodlines in Holland. You know, the Dutch Academies are famous. I read a book about, it was a book about William de Kooning and his training, the way they used to teach people to draw. They would spend like 3 or 4 months on one drawing, like 6 to 8 hours a day on one drawing. I mean, literally.
That's fabulous. That's the way Charlie Parker learned to play saxophone. He tried to sit in with a band and was laughed off stage. So he went and locked himself in his room and played How High the Moon over and over, and then learned it in every key, and then learned it backwards in every key, until he finally really understood the structure of music. That was what was so disappointing about a movie like Bird, is because they showed his excesses, they showed his drug and alcohol abuse, but they didn't show the hard work that he used to make him the greatest jazz alto sax player. And we're kind of trying to get back to movies a little bit here in the discussion, but I think there's a lot of movies that sort of fall down on their history. Like James Cameron chose to do so many inadequacies to the history of Titanic, and Oliver Stone is just rampant in the way he restructures history with a lot of half truths.
Right.
I think there's a responsibility that film has to a degree, because a lot of people now don't read. And if a movie is really well crafted, the viewer is going to believe it.
Right.
And so I think there should be a little bit more responsibility taken by filmmakers to be a bit more factual if it's the kind of movie that is, you know, recreating history.
Right.
That was so great about The Girl with the Pearl Earring. I don't know if you saw that.
I know that it's about Vermeer loosely.
Yeah, it's about Vermeer. It's also about his assistant. And it was also, he was allowing a woman to do something that women weren't allowed to do, which was be an artist's assistant and learn how to mix the paints. And, really wonderful movie.
Yeah, I've definitely heard about it. I've noticed that you have some notes here in front of you that you brought with you, and you've written it on, what is that? You wrote it?
Well, this is something I got in the mail, and I was going to throw it away because it was a time-based art poster, and it was kind of an awful thing. I might as well make some use out of another.
What
one.
Do you think they're doing? The whole, what is in your way of looking at the PICA agenda, without being, you know, rude or unfair about it? What do you think they are accurately reflecting? What we talked about last week and the kind of triumph of advertising, the triumph of commercialism, and
yeah, a little bit. And I think they're also really buying into what I call credential art, where if you go to art school and you get X number of gallery showings, and it's sort of like earning your merit badges for Cub Scouting.
Art is a career rather than art is a way of life, or something like that.
Yeah, kind of like that. So is Van Gogh less of an artist because he didn't go to this art school and no one ever bought his paintings and he wasn't really shown? Does that make him less of an artist? I don't really think so. So the whole credential thing to art sort of bothers me, that people buy into it so heavily. And I know that that gallery owners need to see a resume and they need to see a curriculum vitae and they need to see, you know, what the artist has done. So it does serve a purpose, but I don't think that, it should be based so heavily on that.
I don't think it should be based on that at all. And I think that's one of the key problems in the art world right now, is that it's based more on personality and looks and, again, surface than it is on the actual work. And I think if it were based more on the actual intrinsic content-driven aspect of the work, we'd probably have a different scene out there, and different work would probably be more heavily emphasized. And I think one of the reasons for this, in my mind, is the triumph of relativism, which in and of itself is a very interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the byproducts of the 60s, where relativism basically is saying that any idea is as valid as any other idea. There's no hierarchy, in other words, of ideas. And that's, I think we're seeing the shadow side of that right now, where people are putting, you know, for example, some kind of, Australian Aboriginal drumming on the same aesthetic plane as Beethoven's Ninth. You know, I don't think so, but I'm not saying the drumming isn't valid. It is valid, but it's like comparing a beautifully made, handmade hut with the Chrysler Building. I mean,
right.
the comparison is so far off the chart that it becomes laughable almost. And a lot of stuff like performance art, I read a great quote recently by, you know, it's basically a term that I think makes it so that the anybody can call themselves an artist and do anything and get away with it.
Right. I'm going to go on stage and sit in a chair and that's my art.
Right.
And, what we've done in Tutu Band is sort of, could be oftentimes called performance art.
I would say so, by the way.
We used to have a group that definitely was that. It was called the International Playpen of the Arts, and a lot of it was sort of making mockery of performance art. One thing you'll notice with the performance artists is they rarely smile, because if they smile, then they, you know, internally they feel that that's a chink in their armor and that they'll kind of expose themselves for the BS that they're purporting on people. And then I think a lot also what happens too, there's a lot of grant money, or there used to be a lot of grant money for art, and a lot of that's gone now because it's this sort of self-feeding thing. Like if you look at a work like Pish Jesus, which was an upside down crucifix in a jar of urine,
Toronto, right?
And it was and it was paid for with a grant. So a lot of people who are, you know, strangers to the art world think, well, I don't want my tax dollars going to that. And so it sort of trivializes what a lot of the people who depend on grants to do their artwork do. And then a lot of the artists are guilty by taking, championing that and saying, you know, it's freedom of expression. And freedom of expression is not, does not mean it's art. Doesn't mean it isn't art, but just because somebody expresses something doesn't mean it's a piece of art. An expression is an expression in of itself. It might be artful, it might not.
Right, but I've always been taught that the function of art is something that transforms or transcends what it is at the time. In other words, self-expression, you're absolutely right, is not art at all. Art is always something that is something that transports the viewer to another level.
Right, or even just maybe takes them away from you know some of the just the day-to-day reality. I was sort of criticized a while back by an artist friend of mine, Carly Sertic, that because many of the things I own are landscapes, and or they're kind of sort of nature, and for me it's sort of like, okay, it's like windows outside of my house. Mm-hmm. I look at that piece and then go somewhere else. And so maybe I'm not using it for its art. Maybe I'm using it for, some other purpose instead of an aspirin or a Prozac or something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that an example of what, there's an expressionist tradition, certainly in 20th century art and 20th century music. The German expressionist movement and mm-hmm. the Shostakovich and Bartok and some Stravinsky are expressionist music.
Mm-hmm.
Where that kind of music may be disturbing and dark and labyrinthian in terms of the kind of emotive landscapes that it addresses,
mm-hmm.
but it's not negative in the sense where it makes you feel hopeless. It's more like cathartic, like
some Shostakovich will get you kind of down, though.
Well, if you he. For me personally, mm-hmm. late Beethoven is the same thing as Shostakovich.
Yeah.
Late Beethoven is very dark and disturbing, all that, but it also transports you into another level of some kind. Whereas a lot of personal expression / contemporary mm-hmm. art actually does the opposite. I actually feel like I've been run over by a truck and feel empty and. Maybe that's what they're getting at. I don't know. Maybe the cutting edge art now is accurately reflecting the total nihilism, seemingly, of our culture. And
well, there's also a lot of whininess going on. There's a lot of, like in popular music, there's just a lot of complaining and whininess. And I find myself more and more being drawn to music that's maybe a little more exuberant or kind of embraces the idea that we're living here on this planet, and for me I really can't stand hearing people whine about their problems.
Right. Well, see, I've never been a fan of Bob Dylan's for that very reason. All I think of when I listen to his music is complaining, and I can't get beyond it. And I think that's why he's so important, by the way, is because he's the architect of that kind of music, where it's just poor me, poor, I'm a victim. It's sort of there's a permeation in our culture. Everybody's a victim. Somebody's doing something to me.
It's the antithesis of another popular music of the mid-60s, which was the Brazilian samba and Brazilian jazz, where the lyrics, while they're, just beautiful because they're in Portuguese, but very uplifting and very much just celebrating the joy of life, whether it's just being on the beach and it's sunny and there's the ocean and there's trees and it's and we're there together, and it's very much a celebration of life.
Sort of like Picasso's art. I mean, I just went to Spain in January and looked at a bunch of his work, and I realized just what a titanic genius he is. Because number one, I think it's the confidence that no mm-hmm. one, the art here that could be compared to that, none of it that I've seen has that level of confidence and pure life.
And just the sheer amount of work that he put out, that's, and so much of it is so good.
Right.
There's Picasso museums in every country
major
in
European,
Europe.
Every major European city, right.
And minor European city. I mean, I went to three the last time I went over, and I just barely scratched the surface. That's one thing that's sort of disappointing about America is sort of, you know, the lack of museums. In Paris, there's over 105 museums. I've never been to the Louvre. I've been to Paris many times. I've been to lots of museums in Paris, but I still haven't even been to the Louvre yet.
Well, that's something that really bothers me about Portland, Oregon, and our art museum, is that there's very little emphasis. The shows that they've been importing the last 10 years, only one, I think, has been even a Northwest artist. I mean, I think Lucinda Parker had a show. Uh-huh. And I think currently Hilda Morris is having a show. That's good. But I think generally, I think the museum here should emphasize the incredible art of this region, you know, instead of trying
to... And it's been going on for a long, long time. It's nothing new.
It was different here in the 50s, 40s, and 30s. They did show
absolutely
majorly local artists. But I was talking to Jack Ierley, who I tried to get on this show many times. He's a great guy. Paulie Ierley, his ex-wife, used to work at the museum, and we were both saying he can't even go into the museum anymore because he's so depressed about what they've done. They ripped out the old Rasmussen collection of the Cameroon art. They ripped out the Northwest, you know, the whole Northwest Coast section is gone. It was a beautiful room. Instead, they put up, you know, basically artists that are championed by the top donors of the museum. It's kind of become almost a vanity gallery.
Yeah, that's really sad. I mean, and that's happening all over Portland. Instead of Civic Stadium, it's PGE Park, and it just becomes sort of this, you know, more corporate playland.
It reminds me of another, has anybody seen or have you seen the movie Rollerball, where everything's corporatized? You know, it's not the Portland Trailblazers, it's the Microsoft Trailblazers or whatever. I mean, that would be the equivalent idea. And I think that's where we're headed. I mean, I was talking about Marx with somebody the other day, and they were saying that, you know, Marx did have it right, but people don't realize capitalism is not over yet. What we're seeing now is this hyper late stage capitalism where everything, anything that can be bought and sold is going to be bought and sold. And the other thing is that love itself, I was talking to somebody else who was saying his theory, Nietzsche said that God died in the 1890s, and my friend thinks that love died in the 1990s, and we're living in this era now where love itself has become a commodity.
I mean, well, that, and also we've gone to a place where sentimentality is looked down upon and emotion is looked down upon as we enter this new brutalism, I like to call it. Being an intellectual is looked down upon, but, you know, being brutal is a good thing, and we're in a really real sad state because of it. Ross Perot, you know, crazy as a March hare, but during the debates, he had something really interesting to say, and that was that if we want to improve this country and solve the problems, the first thing that we have to do is teach young children how to learn and to give children unconditional love. And once you do those two things, the other problems eventually work themselves out.
Right. I really do believe what's related to what you just said is that all societal problems are rooted, I think, in child abuse. You know, ultimately, if people are somehow berated or treated badly as children, it's going to have an effect in later years.
And child abuse can even be construed to using the television as a babysitter.
Right.
For the parents wondering, that's sort of an abuse because...
Or junk food or...
Well, there's images that come across on the television that are not necessarily good for the growing mind, and especially when they're unmonitored. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not really one for censorship, but I also think that there has to be a certain responsibility.
Absolutely. You know, and the other thing, now that we're getting on this subject, I think that one of the other subjects that's not addressed at all anymore in our culture is the issue of overpopulation. And Edward Abbey, one of the last things he said before he died, you know, Edward Abbey, desert solitaire guy, he said that somebody asked him, well, what would you do to solve, just like what somebody... You know, the Ross Perot thing, and he said the only way you can solve any problem is to drastically reduce, not just level off, global population and consumption. And it's one of the problems I think happening now is it's another movie. It's almost getting to be like Soylent Green or something. I mean, it's just this bizarre kind of assault on your senses whenever you go anywhere. The grocery store, it's all about queuing. You're waiting in line here. You're waiting in traffic. People are angry everywhere.
Well, you know, Portland definitely is a victim. They've encouraged all this growth, and they don't see the difference between growth and progress. And you can have progress without growth.
Absolutely.
But you're not necessarily going to have progress with growth. And Portland is not as good a place to live as it was in the past with all the growth.
Well, it's gone down. In fact, I keep telling people, I'm glad you're bringing this up, and one of the reasons I wanted you on the air is that people, all these new people moving in who think they run Portland, think they know Portland, or understand it, or champion it, they don't have any knowledge of the history. They have no concept of the idea. There's already been many great artists and great scenes here. For every decade in the last 100 years, there's been major art going on here. It's not like as if suddenly, Pica or White and Kennedy or whatever overnight created an exciting art scene. In fact, quite the contrary. I would say that it's less livable than it used to be.
By far. Yeah. Yeah, the Pearl District is just a blight, and now they're trying to expand that, you know, into further reaches
trying
of the city.
To, well, they already have.
Yeah.
And it makes you realize that most of the people that are allowing that to happen are on the take, or it's all corruption. You know, it reminds me of like a noir movie. And then you find out that many of the Pearl buildings are so cheaply built that they're already falling apart. You know, and they tear down these beautifully made. I just heard recently that the Guild Theater is slated to be torn down. I'm really bummed about that.
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah, it's just awful. And that kind of thing. And I also heard that the entire part of the Southwest downtown near Cameron's Bookstore is basically, there's huge pressure to doze all that and to put up, you know, these sterile styrofoam, hideous, soulless towers. You know, and when my point is, once they're gone forever. It's sort of like old-growth forest. And what bothers me now is what's contributing to the monoculture, I think, locally, is you go to these Pica things, or you go to these events, or go to gallery openings, and there's nobody I even recognize. I mean, I don't even know who these people are anymore. There's these sort of strange new imports that have moved in here that they all look the same, they all dress the same, they all seem to have all this money, and yet they don't have any real soulful investment in where we came from and how we got here, and they don't realize that it's the founders of Portland, the enlightened founders of Portland, who created Forest Park, the largest in-city park in the United States, by the way. They would never, the people now would never even think of doing something like that. Something for the... So I think that we are... Here's my take. I think we're de-evolving. I think we're going... I mean, I don't know how else to put it. You know?
Well, Portland, the Portland I grew up in was much more of a city.
And right, I agree with
right
that.
Right downtown, there were, you know, several farmers markets downtown, and there were many kosher delis, and there was grand movie palaces. There was a bus system that went all hours of the day.
The Rose City Special.
Rose City Transit,
right, right.
And Tualatin Valley Transfer,
right.
Before it merged and became TriMet. The bus service was much better.
Right.
You didn't have to drive your car. You could get home on a bus if you'd had too many drinks. And and there were cigar stores and newsstands and theaters that, you know, with bums in them. And it was just,
right.
It felt kind of more of a Times Square aspect. And it really felt like a bustling city, rather than sort of a big gentrified town.
Well, you know what Charles Bukowski says, one of my favorite quotes of his, is when you clean a city up, you wreck it.
Yeah.
I mean, when you clean it up
absolutely.
Too much. When you clean anything up too much, you wreck it. It's good to have an aspect of reality, like you said. I remember Callan Novelties. I remember the Blue Mouse Theater. All these things that are gone from our history. And it's being replaced by these new kind of things like Pica, which, by the way, was founded by somebody that isn't even from here. The new curator at the art museum doesn't... This is a true story. I happened to go there about 5 months ago.
Uh-huh.
And there was a Clifford Gleason painting labeled with a different name on it. And I called them up and said, don't you realize Clifford Gleason's a major, you know, Portland artist? And they did not even know about it. And so I called them up. And then I realized, well, the head of the Northwest Collection is not even from here. And she probably doesn't even know who Clifford Gleason is. And so that's what I'm talking about. It's like this kind of lack of respect by default because of, you know, by people that don't have any investment in the history of this area.
Yeah, the tradition of historical art in Portland has largely been lost. David Milholland actually has done some really great seminars to re-educate people with the Oregon Historical Society on some of these lost and historic artists, whether it's, you know, Clyde Keller or Eliza Barkus or some of those names from the early part of the century that, you know, made the Portland art scene what it is. Getting kind of back to the film thing, Beaverton Studios in the 20s was the number one feature film producer in the country. So Portland does have...
You're kidding me, I didn't.
Has a, and Boris Karloff was their romantic lead.
Beaverton, Oregon?
Beaverton, Oregon.
Well, you know, Clark Gable lived here.
Clark Gable lived here, and so anyway, Portland does have kind of a long film tradition.
And Mark Rothko lived here, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
A lot of people don't know that. And
it was, the film community was sort of gone for a while, but... It started back up in the late 80s, and that's what brought me back from Los Angeles. I'm really glad it's here.
Well, it's great that you're here. I mean, without people like you, this place would be pretty much unlivable. I consider you one of the heroes of my life and of the city, one of the city's treasures we've had on the air for the last 2 days, and it's been a pleasure having you, Greg.
I really appreciate it.
And he is a founding member of the 2-2 band, and you're going to play again where?
We're
talk to Greg later on this summer.
Well, June 17th, we played at Brad Stock down in Corvallis.
Did you say July, June, or
no,
July?
No, June 17th.
So coming right up.
Right.
Okay, I didn't realize that. Yeah. So everybody, June 17th down at Brad Stock near Corvallis?
Yeah, it's just north of Corvallis at Brad's World of Reptiles.
Is there a website people can...
I don't think there is, okay. No. But you can go to 22band.com.
Okay, 22band.com if you want to some meet Greg in person sometime. Well, it's been a pleasure having you.
It's been a pleasure being here. Thank you, Tom.
It's been two sessions in a row, unprecedented. We've had the same person for 2 shows. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
To KBOO 90.7 Portland, Oregon. Coming up next on Democracy Now!, guests include Sarah Rich, mother of Suzanne Swift, the Eugene soldier arrested for refusing to return to Iraq, and Peter Laufer, Vietnam War resistor and author of Mission Rejected, U.S. Soldiers Who Say No to Iraq. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, hosting its 22nd anniversary celebration and the grand opening of Gazelle Full Circle Resale, also featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Both events run June 16th through 25th. Gazelle and Full Circle Resale are both located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont. Information at 503-288-3422. And now stay tuned for Democracy Now!